So welcome back. Hope you guys had a good break, good lunch, depending on your time zone and where you are. And I hope you've made it through the first couple of modules with us. And we're kind of really keen now to get into the meat of it. And this is actually the next phase, pushing out the release, pushing code out. What are the requirements? What are the things to look at? And so hopefully having some fun, some good chat online. Keep the questions coming. It really is handy for us to get a view of exactly what you guys are talking about, what your interests are. And as a takeaway, please communicate with us offline. It doesn't have to be directly now through the chat window. You do have our contact details on the slide itself. That will come up in a few minutes. And please keep that going.
Yeah. Yeah. So Morgan's going to continue to kick us off with the on-premises side of the house here.
Cool. There you go. So we're going to focus now on that release phase. And how do developers take the code that they've been massaging, working with, and push it out through a variety of stages? So the focus areas that we're going to be looking at now is kind of defining what a release process is from a Microsoft perspective. How do we look at the pieces that make up a release process? How do we handle multiple environments? And again, based on the developer's requirements, those environments can be either on-premises or, if required, with a bit of work and effort, pushing it out to a public instance and allowing you to actually start to play in that hybrid model. And then kind of closing off with these continuous delivery. What is continuous delivery and how does that play a part in the whole story that we've been going through now as an operations person, enabling and supporting developers? So if we take a look at that first piece, defining a release process. So Microsoft had an acquisition about 12 months-ish or so ago, I estimate. A product called InRelease. It now is part of Visual Studio as the Visual Studio Release Management. And we'll spend a bit of time now on that. And we'll focus really on, as an operations person, what should you be doing to assist the developers configure, build out, expand, and have tools available for them to use within release management that allows them to provision as simply as possible and move their code from one stage to the following, all the way to production and on. So if we have a quick jump across to the demo machine here. If I just can open it up, okay. So from an interface perspective, this is release management, part of the Visual Studio brand. And all we're going to kind of understand is that firstly, I've missed a slide in the earlier piece.
Yeah.
I do apologize and jump back to the deck one more time.
Yeah, it's good, so you can kind of see it like conceptually in our framework.
Yeah.
And then we'll actually show you the same thing and then snap back to the framework so you kind of hopefully solidify the concept here.
100%. And I've got to get away from that eagerness of actually wanting to show consoles opposed to PowerPoint. So yeah. There's a kind of three animations in the slide. Really, we've moved across from using source control, working within creating builds and testing our builds. We now want to move into that release phase. So release management for Visual Studio has a release management server, which is the core component for how you would configure and build out the relevant components that you would need to actually start to leverage and move the code through the different areas. So in this graphic, as we see it now, business, developer, operations, they all play a role. They all play a role either through the release management client or through a browser to actually either create the relevant pieces or to actually approve, confirm, make security changes, or actually have a view of configuring release management to talk to the backend infrastructure on the other side, whether it be Exchange, whether it be TFS, or Microsoft Azure. So at the moment, using either the release management client or the browser, those three personas can talk and configure the release management server and the relevant components on top of that. Within the release management piece, there are three areas that we kind of want to focus on. The paths that are required, the templates that get used, and what are the workflows around that to actually allow developers to move their code from phase to phase, and then at the end of the day, leverage the environments that the IT pro has made available, has configured, has created for them. Now, you'll see on this graphic that we have the layout below the release management server, which is the core configuration components required for the release management server. And on the right-hand side, the environments. The environments, again, made up of a server, a number of servers, but having the actual deployment agent sitting on side of those servers to pull content as required from the release management server. So if a change is made, an update is made, a configuration is made within the release management component, those agents will be able to pull and apply and run accordingly on the particular server that it's destined to run on in that particular environment. And this is where there's a fine overlap now between operations assisting build out the requirements for those environments and the developers ironing out exactly what they require, to be inside of all of those particular containers for the environments. So we'll jump across now back to that same screen I showed you a few minutes ago, and we'll focus on two or three key areas. One is understanding what is this release path, what are these workflows, what are these templates, what do they look like, what interaction could I have as an operations person in enabling the developers to have as slick as possible process using release management, and then going across to environments. What are inside of those environments? How do they look? What is the feel around them? And that'll kind of set us to the point where we've moved from building our code, we're now testing, we're starting to release and move it through the various phases, and ultimately get to the production launch of pushing that application out to a private or public cloud, depending on those components. So for now, we'll focus on on-premises, and we'll have a look and see exactly what is release management, what are the key areas in IT pros you care about, because there is quite a bit of content within release management. But let's focus on a few of those areas where operations can enable the developer to do a lot more as well outside of the inside of the tool itself. So if we flick across again to my demo machine and have a quick look. So this is the console for release management, and there is quite a bit of configuration requirements. There's quite a few configuration steps. In the ultimate Nirvana scenario, we want to have release management configured to integrate with as many infrastructure components as possible, whether it be Team Foundation Server, whether it be Exchange, whether it be a System Center component, whether it be just with PowerShell or using desired state configuration. We want different components to be used as often as possible to make that cycle of releasing code out through those different stages as simple as possible and as quick as possible. Because if we start to move the code quickly through those phases, the iterations come a lot faster from an updates perspective. That's a benefit to the business, it's a benefit to the developer, and in the long run, it's a benefit to the operations person, having faster, consistent applications that are being released out into the various stages. So we're going to focus on a couple of areas. In the top right-hand side, you'll see there's a Configure Paths tab. And within that, I'm going to open up the actual Fabricam application that we have around the actual paths that are configured for this one. And you'll see that on the bottom left-hand side, we have that breakout there showing us the different stages. Now, currently, we have three stages sitting over there, a development one, a QA, and a production one. This is very malleable depending on the application, depending on the developer, depending on how many teams are involved in possibly testing this application. There could be just dev prod. There could be dev, QA, UAT1, UAT2, pre-prod, prod. That really is down to the interaction that you're going to have with the operations and business people to understand how many of these environments would you actually need to have sitting inside of these release pods. So it really is a matter of saying add new one. It pops up on the right-hand side. You can select whatever stage you want to have, then define the actual environments that you want to use within that particular stage, and then work your way through who the relevant personas, groups, or people will be that are going to be responsible for approving, validating, and moving that code from one location to the next. And this is where that planning stage that we mentioned at the beginning of our day today becomes really important. If you're sitting down with the analyst, with development, as operations, need to ask the question, who is going to be responsible for approving? Who's going to be responsible for moving to the next stage? Because if that is a persona, a group, let it be an Active Directory persona, an Active Directory group. Now, ideally, developers can use native local groups to move this process through. But in the longer run, the longer story, we want to start to move towards this total integration with operations around auditing, logging, security, tracking, and workflows outside of the generic workflows that you have within release management. So yeah, simple look and feel. I can create these, I can move them left or right. Really, not a lot of rocket science behind creating these. The meat really is about how do I configure and complete the different components inside of this to ensure not only the workflow works, but also that the relevant personas or groups are responsible for moving the code successfully from one location to the next as quickly as possible. So yes, we have our release pods, but now inside of those release pods, we need to have our environments. In the PowerPoint slide, we had a look at the environments breaking out as containers. There were a couple of servers inside of those, and then we had the relevant agents sitting inside of those servers installed, ready to pull content from the release management server. So if we have a look at the environments tab, you'll see we have a couple of environments that are pre-built, and those are the drop-down ones that I had a look at a little bit earlier. If I just open one of those, I have the ability now to come in, and this is a bit of a base configuration, but I have the ability to come in here and start to get quite granular around how many servers in here, what type of servers do we have, what technology supported types are there available that's going to be supported by the server. So I can get quite granular. This, however, is now where operations need to provide input back to the developers. Understand what do they want out of the server? What do they want configured on it? What do they want used? Right, we can add that into the relevant environment to be used going forward. Now, those couple of screens really just give us a view of the back-end pieces that need to be in place to allow developers to build out their workflow of how an app is going to move, firstly, through the stage, but then from stage to stage on the other side. So to graphically represent that, if we move back to configure apps and we open up the Fabricam one and have a quick look at that, this gives us a graphical representation now of each of those different components that we spoke about now. There was the dev, the QA, and the prod that we looked at a little bit earlier where I added the dummy one in. These are now the three locations where we will have a flow of an application and what is going to happen within that application. If this, then this. If deploying to QA, use this account, be named this, use this version. If it's going to prod, use this content, etc. And this is where developers will start to build out their sequence and a workflow of a logical representation of this app deploying within that stage and then moving from stage to stage on the left at the top. However, on the left-hand side, this is where I'd like to point a bit more attention for an operations person. The toolbox becomes key for the developers. This is where now we can arm the developers and enable them to do a lot more outside of the native components that are within release management. Simple things like using PowerShell, custom PowerShell scripts that we might use every day as developers to either configure a server, change a server, audit a server, look at a server. Little things like that, we can start to import these and create them as tools within release management and allow developers to call those as they see fit within the sequence of an application being deployed. A simple example to think of is Windows Azure or Microsoft Azure. I'm not going to put some money in the jar every time I say Windows Azure, but Microsoft Azure. So natively, we can deploy to local environments. What if I want to burst out? What if I don't want to deploy to local and I only want to go to the public cloud-facing side? Then I need to be able to have the ability to create tools and give the developers the ability to work with those. If I open up this now, have a quick look inside of this. Oh, came to the wrong side, sorry. I just lost my component. There we go. Back into the inventory section. The actions are what you saw within the left-hand side that was available to me. Within the tools, this is where I can come and be and create custom configuration pieces. Ideally, it is not the best process to have a huge list of tools available here, because not only to make it complicated for developers to use, you might find that with having so many, they might start to neglect and start to use less and less of them. And again, move away from being dynamic and more back to static components that they would manually put in their workflows. So as a simple example, if we open one here, the Azure VM Manager, just as a brief run through, just to give you a view of the actions that are required from a content perspective. Really, what am I going to be running? Well, it's going to be a PowerShell command that's going to be running. What are the arguments that I need to be inputting for this? God love Zoom at moving out that one very, very quickly. Do apologize for that. What areas do I actually want to use? This is gone all over the place. Right.
You got you should touch the screen. Nice. And you can draw on the screen with your hand.
Look at that. Hello.
See, there you go.
Right. Yeah. Let's keep this real again. Laughing in the background over there. Very funny. I'm the guy doing it over here. Anyway, let's get back to this. That's a bit better. Red and square.
I like the smiley faces personally.
Yeah, I feel that might come back to haunt me later on. Okay. So from a tools perspective, I can now define we're running PowerShell. These are the arguments. These are the variables that need to be answered to complete. And ideally, if I do have some custom scripts, I can add those in as well. So a very good example is, yes, I can run through those different paths and I can assign them to local private cloud resources, local physical servers. But if I want to break out and I want to start using my Azure subscription as a developer, I need to start having some of these components in my toolbox that I can use. My subscription, my VM, start, stop, etc. And this becomes the release management kind of story to not only address the private cloud, but start to look at moving across from an Azure perspective. What else can we do when we start to release components out into a public-facing cloud with Microsoft Azure? I think there was any more slides, Dave?
So if you want to do a quick recap of of everything that you've shown here, just so people can have a good idea, and then Cool, and then we'll move on to the Azure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jump on my PowerPoint on my machine there. Okay.
Cool. So just as a recap, in the deployment green one, we have a release management server, configuration required. Recommendation is for operations to spend time with developers, understand how you can configure end-to-end and work with other infrastructure components, and then a system with the paths, the templates, and the workflows. Natively, they'll understand those processes, but ideally arm them with the relevant components and tools to actually give them more out of release management. The focus area for yourself then becomes the environments of where the apps are going to reside. Do I have local environments in physical servers? Do I use virtual servers? Do I possibly burst out to the public cloud? And those are the key areas from a high-level view of where release management fits in and the operations role within that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different shift, right, for folks that are out there today where, you know, you have, you know, traditionally you think about infrastructure as... Okay. Traditionally, you think about infrastructure as a, you know, on-premises VM or server, right? And this is a little bit of a shift, right? We're now in this DevOps world where it could be a script that pushes to Microsoft Azure. It could be that you're using this release process to control the flow of the updates to whatever it is that you want to control. Morgan also pointed off towards the end there the fact that we have a PowerShell script, right, to deploy to really whatever you want. So, you know, there is a Microsoft Azure Script Center that I highly encourage everyone to check out, and that also has a link to the TechNet PowerShell script gallery. But there are a ton of base scripts to configure and provision Microsoft Azure infrastructure out there today and do all kinds of things with PowerShell. So here's where really, as an IT guy, using your existing automation PowerShell skills is gonna come in handy and be directly applicable to these processes. So making the switch now over to the public cloud side of the house, we're going to talk about Azure VMs and the application-based deployments, right? Earlier, we showed how we deployed, using a PowerShell script, a Microsoft Azure website. In this particular case, right, we could do a mechanism to use PowerShell to deploy a new VM, even possibly configure that VM using PowerShell remotely. And provision a SQL database up in Microsoft Azure. Now, at some point, though, you probably would want to also connect that up to source code. And in this particular case, we're doing just a manual copy, avoiding the actual build. Now, if you remember earlier in the development section, that's really less than ideal, right? Because when you just pull whatever code is in source code, you're not really sure that it compiles and that it's valid, right? Now, you definitely can do this, but I wanted to bring this up here because it kind of highlights the, I guess, limitation of just deploying VMs up there, right, and manually copying the source code, which is, hey, I need probably some kind of build automation process to automatically kick off the builds, fire off the builds, and then do my deployments based upon that known build in the process. Well, we have... you know, the release management product, but if you're not using a release management product, we also have a number of open source tools that would do the job, right? Jenkins, Grunt, Gradle, and Hudson in this particular case are ones that up here, right, are the ones that really relate to that particular build process, right? And you'll notice here some of those actually tie back into the deployment as well. So this is really what we're talking about when we think about continuous integration, continuous deployment. Right, so you could theoretically integrate those open source tools, or again use our release management product. And in this case, right, it would be kind of a hybrid story because in-release is a on-premises type of product. I want to focus specifically on how Puppet can help fill that gap. And so I'm going to give you an explanation of what Puppet actually does. So you kind of have some context for one open source tool. Now, I also want to point out the fact that we do support a wide range of tools. So by me telling you just about Puppet here, I'm not endorsing or saying Puppet is the only way to go. I'm just saying this is one particular example. So you have a rough idea of what Puppet and Chef do. They're very similar in the way they function. So in this case, right, we've got these things called Puppet modules. The Puppet modules here, we have security, settings, and resources. So this is just a definition of what you want to define for your deployments that are out there. You also have, and those go get uploaded to the Puppet server, you also have a definition of your application, perhaps a SQL server and a web server, all of those which compose the application that you want to go ahead and deploy. Those then also get defined up in the Puppet Master server. Now, once you go and fire up a number of VMs, Microsoft has now, we announced at Build, native integration with Chef and Puppet agents. So if you wanted to deploy a VM, it's like a checkbox or a switch on the deployment to say, yes, include the Puppet or the Chef agent on side of those VMs. So here you can see, right, that you've got that little icon that means that's the Puppet agent on each single VM. So what happens is once that agent fires up on the network, it's able to then to talk to your configured Puppet Master server. And so in this case, right, it connects up, it detects it, and then based upon those module definitions that you have in Puppet, it's going to automatically configure those virtual machines based upon that definition inside of the environment. So in this way, you're not doing the continuous integration and the continuous build, but you are doing a different kind of way of automating and enforcing that configuration and deploying it inside the VMs inside of your environment, right? So if we click next, this is how you might actually integrate not only the Puppet, but you wanted to have that continuous integration with a build server. So here, right, a continuous integration process at a high level means that every time you commit to a source code repository, that's going to then generate a build and do a number of tests, right? So here, in this case, we've set up, let's say, Jenkins and connected that up to Visual Studio Online. That Jenkins is also configured to talk to the Puppet Master. Now, you could theoretically, right, have Jenkins running as a VM inside of Azure as well. In this case, just to keep it simple, I left it as generic in the build box. And you could as well have a Puppet Master server that happened to be on premises, but you would obviously have to have a virtual private connection up to the resources in Azure if you wanted to manage those. But what would happen here is if a developer goes in, commits changes to source code control, that's Jenkins is going to detect that and automatically create a build of that software. Now, once Jenkins does that, it's also going to have that notification pass along to the Puppet Master and then to the Puppet agent, which is on that particular VM. That VM, the Puppet Master is going to tell that VM and say, oh, hey, there's new code for you to deploy. And it's going to then contact that Jenkins server, pull down that known build that's there, and actually apply that on the VMs itself. So this is just one simple example, or kind of complex example, I would say, right, of how you might integrate some tools together to do that automation and continuous integration and continuous deployment using a VM infrastructure, right? So there's quite a lot that goes on here, right? You're going to need to set up a Jenkins server. You're going to need to set up a Puppet Master, set up the Puppet agents and clients, right? So define all those modules and all those scripts. And I mean, you could definitely do that. And there are some advantages to it. But on the flip side, I would say things are much easier today when you look at continuous integration and deployment with Azure websites, or it's very similar with our cloud services as well, our platform as a service offerings. And what would happen here is, in this case, right, you would set up a connection between your website and the source code, which is there in Visual Studio Online. Now, today, you can do this with the current Azure Management Portal as well as the new one. When you do that, what happens is when you do that, effectively, it acts also as a deployment engine. So Microsoft Azure is going to do that continuous integration with the builds as well as the deployment of the website itself. So here, right, in this same example, we're going to commit a new update to the Git source code repository. Visual Studio Online in conjunction with Azure is going to create that new build automatically. And then Microsoft Azure will say, oh, I know there's a new build there, and it's going to automatically deploy that build into the Microsoft Azure website. So there, right, you know, there's a lot less moving parts, right? I mean, that there's no physical servers to set up. There's no Jenkins, there's none of that there. And even in this case, you don't have a release management server in place. But you do have, right, an easy way to get this running. So, you know, it also provides an advantage with Azure websites and cloud service in making it easy to switch environments. Right now with Morgan's product, you know, release management that he showed off, right, you have a very defined, you have a lot of controls that are there around setting very, you know, detailed requirements around builds and workflows and things like that. So that is kind of the flip side, right, to this, right? You don't have all of that granular control like you would have in release management if you only wanted to use this method of continuous integration and deployment. But nonetheless, right, it's a trade-off, you know, and you could put theoretically, right, use these in conjunction too, right, having the two connected, but that's a little more beyond our scope today with the hybrid story. So what does it look like to move environments, right, if you were to do this integration story? Well, remember we already said we set up this continuous integration here, and what you might want to do is do what we're calling a deployment slot inside of Microsoft Azure. Effectively what that is it's a copy of the exact configuration that you have. And this deployment slot, what it would enable you to do is if that ops guy or whoever it is that's down there knows you go and check in a bunch of code to, let's say, you know, to staging over here, right? And you say, okay, that seems to look good. Then what I want to do is, based upon that configuration, I want to now swap that out, right? So effectively what happened is that code that you had there becomes now active with the click of a couple buttons here as your main production environment. So right there, you can still have the integration of the continuous integration with the source code when you make changes there, but you also have another lever here if you'd like to swap between those two environments for testing purposes. Now, this can get kind of tricky and more advanced beyond our discussion here, as far as there's different strategies, right? You could have multiple Git branches and have the continuous integration and deployment across different Git branches that are there. And you could also have multiple Azure subscriptions. So what we see a lot of customers doing is having this scenario that's involved, where they'll have, let's say, two Azure subscriptions. One might be their dev test environment, one might be their more production environment. And across both of those, they would have a production and a staging slots for both dev test in one subscription and in production. And then that would allow them to kind of move that through those flows, right? They would have a dev test environment where it has that continuous integration. And then at some point you'd use that source code there to copy it over to production and still have those deployment slots to kind of move it along. So with that, I want to try and help make this a little more visual for you, because I know it's a lot of concepts that we're throwing at you here. And what I'd like to do is show you the new Azure Management console and show you a little bit about resource groups and what that looks like, and then show you the powerful integration that we have today with our Team Foundation server, our source code control, and then I'll do a little bit of where you would do that deployment slot swap in the environment within the Azure Management console. So I'm going to go ahead and switch now to my demo machine. Let me flip over there. Okay, so here we're logged into the new Microsoft Azure Management portal, all right? And as you can see, it's a very different experience than what we had over here. And, you know, you get like kind of a blue screen, right, from what we saw earlier today, whereas here it's a very rich, different-looking environment. What I want to do is first deploy something using the gallery. So first off, I'll just click on Gallery. And everything inside the gallery is going to utilize resource groups to do deployment. So for instance, if I choose website plus SQL, it's going to give me a description of what that is. And then if I choose create, it's going to then move to another slice. So each one of these little chunks of window here are called slices, right? So every time you click, it kind of moves on to a slice. And when we click on this, right, we have the option to configure what do we want for the database or the website, what kind of web hosting plan do we want to achieve, and you can see all the way down here we have different web hosting plans based on, you know, and it gives you an estimated monthly cost and what are some of the features that are included there. I'm not going to go through a full deployment of a new website, but this is just to give you the initial idea of what's involved here with creating a new resource. Underneath the hood here, this is going to all deploy to a central resource group. So what I'm going to do now is switch gears a tad, and we're going to go back to what we're calling a journey, right? So you can see here, this is kind of a series of a journey that we had here that we did with this gallery. And when I click on journeys, this gallery flow of down to the right is what we just experienced. Now, earlier what I did is went to a team project and an existing deployment that I had. So I'm going to click on that now. And you'll notice here, it automatically kind of fills in a number of blades off to the right of my previous clicking. Essentially, what I did here is browse one of the team projects that I had in Visual Studio Online. And this is one of the key advantages that you're going to see of the portal, is the fact that we have this rich integration. So you'll notice here I've got a resource group. That resource group is called VSFF Demo Group, right? And within that demo group, we've got Fabricram Fiber, we have Forefront Demo, MVA Demo Site, and a SQL database, right? So this is really the first time with resource groups where you can really group everything together in a logical view for your application. When you click on that, right, and we click on this list here, you can see a number of those different resources. You could filter based on them. You could add additional resources into this list. You could also see, you know, billing and cost estimates for those particular resource groups. Let's head back to the resource groups here. So that's a little bit about resource groups, okay? But really where even more power starts to come in is the fact that you can integrate and have visibility into all of the different components of your software development lifecycle. So for instance here, right, we see that we have a source code repository. We have the number of commits into that source code repository, build definitions that are happening. What I'll do is I'll click on this website. And within this website, I'll talk about, you know, the deployment slots that are there. So here, if we were to, let's say, commit some code to a different location. Now, I've already set up an enabled continuous integration and continuous deployment, which you would also do here via the portal. Which is beyond the scope of a discussion today. But once you do that, you set up a deployment slot, and really just switching out the environments is really that simple. So I'll click staging, I'll click select, right? And there, it's going to swap the environments out. And on the left-hand side, you'll notice everything that I'm doing has a notification. So up here, you can see, right, it's swapping deployment slots for this particular website. Okay. Eventually, that's going to switch out, and this is all done seamlessly behind the scenes, to where you're not going to have downtime when you swap those out. Assuming, of course, you've got a working staging environment that's up and running. So, right there, we've showed you a little bit about resource groups. We've showed you how that you can do deployment swaps, right, from within your website. But then let's keep going, right? what you can do, okay, it just hit success, it just swapped it out for me, right? But what you can also do is move forward on to the source code, right? So let's say that I actually want to make a change to the website itself directly. What I can do here, I'm going to click on the source code repository. It's going to pull up using Git. You notice it's got the Git icon. It could also be TFVC if you wanted. I'm going to click on my Fabricam Fiber app. I see here I've got a staging and a master branch. I'll click on my master branch. I see the number of commits that were made and different people amongst the team that made those commits. I can also click on the source code itself, right? I'm going to click on code, and this is my source code. So if I want to go in here and I want to make a change, I'm going to go into views, and let's say I want to go to my homepage. Okay, this is now a source code editor all within the same view. If I click on edit, all right, and you know this is the header of that web page, the dashboard. If I just said dashboard, I don't know, new for MVA, and then I hit commit, okay, this is going to now commit a change directly, and this is all from within the web console, right? So here, and maybe this just didn't click, but I hit commit, and now based on that commit, we're going to then have a change that's made, right, to our source code, and automatically we're going to start to have builds happen from this. Okay, so let's then go see, oh, here we go. It needs, that was what I missed here. On the flight on the right-hand side, it said, and this is a best practice in Git, right? Really almost a requirement. You need to comment what you changed with the source code. So in this case, I'm just going to say updated the title. I'm going to say OK. OK, and then what you're seeing up top here was kind of subliminal. You said, hey, commit committed successfully to the Git repo, right? And on the left-hand side, go back here to the repo. Sometimes the management console, it is in preview, so it does kind of have some hiccups occasionally, but it should reserve my journey that I had here previously, right? So it looks like it did reserve my journey. And let's go back here. So what'll happen here, right, is based on that continuous integration and deployment, it's going to then have the commit. So here you see just now. Okay. So just now, I actually did a commit to the source code repo, right? What that does, and you'll see this on the left-hand side, is that based on that commitment, it's going to automatically do a new build of that software. All right. So here it's coming up. Okay. We might come back to the portal here in a second.
Give it a green smiley face.
Yeah, let's do that. it is working behind the scenes here and doing the commitments to the page, and that was kind of the closing here to our demo. Right after we make that source code change, the build's going to happen. It's going to automatically deploy. It's going to give you those notifications on the top to what you had. I think we'll come back to that, and we're going to talk to some slides first here. Let that kind of clear itself up.
Cool.
So let's head back here. So to this. So one of the other concepts I want to talk about here, right, is a thing that's really important for IT folks, right? Helping optimize costs. Now, for cloud-based environments, there's some really cool stuff that you can do here. For instance, you may have a dev test, you may have a whole bunch of resources that are up there inside the environment, and you need a way to really kind of clean those up. Well, the Microsoft Azure Automation Service has the ability for you to save and run custom runbooks inside of your environment that use right PowerShell. And what would happen is if you, on a certain schedule or manually, you can go and fire those tasks off. And what will happen is that script would then go ahead and deprovision those resources. Now, this is just one example of deprovisioning. You could also use the service, right, to power down VMs, right? So shut them down so you no longer get billed for them. You could also use them to fire up new environments. You want a whole, you know, dev test client environment, you could use the automation service to fire those things up. You know, these are things that a developer's probably not going to then take the effort to go forward and do. Whereas the IT guy, you could come in there and, right, kind of help save the day and say, wow, this is pretty amazing that I now have this client environment there and I'm able to just connect up and run. And then the business is happy, right? Because they're saving costs and not just letting this infrastructure run constantly all the time.
And I mean, David, that has been one of the biggest concerns with IT pros enabling developers is the one big downside to virtualization, which is VM sprawl. We just have VMs being spun up, getting used. We have no idea what they're being used for, never get spun down, never get deleted. And that's why there's always been this barrier around self-service for developers, enabling them to actually start building out infrastructures, but then us having the confidence to rely that they're going to deprovision that at some point, kind of along the way.
Yep. So, you know, there's quite a few options for deprovisioning that are out there, right? I mean, so if we go back to the earlier slide where we talked about, you know, all of the different automation methods, the same automation methods you use to deploy, you could use to remove resources pretty much, right? But you may want to have a service around that to help. From the cloud's perspective, the Azure Automation Service would be your answer there, where it doesn't require any on-premises infrastructure to do that kind of scheduled tasks and automation and having some kind of workflow around it.
And I mean, if we extend a little bit more to on-premises as well, it does become not of the out-of-the-box tool sets, but you would need to customize some sort of workflow and some sort of inventory or scraping of the environment to see last used, last logged on, last started from a virtualization perspective, and then tie that back into a workflow process, which would possibly kick off an email, kick off a text message, or kick off a thread that says, right, your security group that you are the owner of has built this environment. Do you still need it? Do you still need these virtual machines? And possibly with a little bit of data, last logged on was 30 days ago or 60 days ago. approve, deny, delete, whatever it may be. No, we still need that. Great. So really start tying back into the integration of Service Manager with Orchestrator, as well as the normal environments that are out there at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it does require a bit of manual work to do that. But obviously, natively, that is what the automation self-service piece of Service Manager and Orchestrator is about, to give us that functionality. It just requires a bit of operations intelligence to put in and build and create those workflows. If we've discussed release now end-to-end, and we've understood the phases, we've understood environments, we've understood locations of where you can push to, where you can deploy to. So as a kind of a completion for this section, when we look at hybrid cloud, we have the ability to deploy onto private cloud on premises. We have the ability to go to Azure if required. Natively, out of the box, it might not give us straight away the manual deployment to Azure from release management, but we have the configuration and tools available to customize and create that for the developers to use. If we're just going to Azure, obviously David showed you some great simple sample demos out of the new portal, the ability to have all that process available to you immediately without worrying about something like release management. But in large enterprises, large dev houses, you want to have that chain of flow, that workflows as an app moves from stage to stage. That kind of ties in with an interesting question that was asked before we kind of close off the section was, in the real world, how do I ensure that someone has the responsibility to approve as it moves from phase to phase? And the example was given a project manager. He has the rights to say, yes, you've met this criteria, these tests have been passed, approve, move to the next one. And not allow the developers or the business analyst or the IT pro guy to go, yeah, I'm happy with that look and feel, right, approve, out you go into production. So that is there within the workflow. But however, that's where the conversation starts with the IT pro and operations in the planning phase. How do we define your integration of release management with the likes of an Active Directory security group? How do we define ownership of those groups having the required permissions to move an app from stage to stage? Yes, that ensures we have workflow, but it also ensures there's a comeback from tracking perspective and from a logging perspective. And really moving away from that he said, she said, I don't know anymore, let's just roll out a new update possibility in the long run. So yes, to answer back to, I think it was Carlos on the chat, definitely, that is part of the process, but I hope you understand from the view that David and I have given you in the release phase, you need to have integration with the operations team and developers to actually build out those kind of boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're going to do the kind of the wrap-up slide of kind of what we've covered here today. In this particular module, right, it's helping you figure out, right, you know, for an ops person, right, building and releasing that software, and you're helping to work through that process to help define, you know, the flow of where this app is going to live, making sure that there's a properties, controls, things in place that are there, and then assisting the setup and continuous integration and deployments where it makes sense, deprovisioning that infrastructure or automatically provisioning that infrastructure to the new environments or where things need to be moved to.
And that deprovision is going to play to your comment earlier around optimizing costs.
Right.
So if we are constant around deprovisioning unrequired resources, we bring the cost down, there's no need for new servers, new upgrades, no more costs. The picture starts to get a lot better by showing we're saving by making people dynamic on the other side.
Yeah. We also want to point out, I mean, you know, we are sticking to phases here in this jumpstart, but naturally some of this stuff is going to play a part in different roles too, right? So you may need to deprovision dev test environments, right? Not necessarily when you get to release, right? So that could be something where you could apply there. But you know, this is where we're trying to roughly have a mapping of the lifecycle. Obviously, when you move between environments, you're now going to be in a release phase because you've moved past, you know, write a dev test. But you know, there's a little bit of a blur, a little in some of these things, right?
I mean, I've seen some of the questions on the chat really around that. How do we deprovision? Because that is a real-world problem for operations. I have sprawl all over the place. So it's good to understand the tools that are available. If you own System Center, the components are there to allow you to do that. Mm-hmm. If it's on the Azure side, you're obviously able to work a bit more from an automation perspective to deprovision, as you see fit.
Yeah, when you have infrastructure as a code, it really makes things a lot easier too. There's, you know, deprovisioning scripts are much easier than provisioning scripts. I'll just say that, right? Because when you're just get rid of everything inside of a subscription, I even have a script that I run which says everything with resource name of a specific initial suffix, get rid of all of those things, right? So there's the deprovisioning process is not bad, but you obviously, the big thing would be tying in it to your overall workflow, right? I mean, that's the big thing of things, right? You can just deprovision everything, but you need to have context over the overall lifecycle of what you're deprovisioning, right?
Surprise.
So yeah. And there was a really good question here too, on relating to the ITIL and the processes. How can I ensure, right? And you kind of touched on that a little bit. I also want to, you know, tackle that a little bit well as well myself. You know, how do you control that with your processes? How do you kind of enforce those things? Well, I'd say part of that, and the biggest thing I'd say to start with, is back to that people and that processes side of things, right? Because, you know, you don't want to be, like, if you're really in a true DevOps mindset, you don't want to be that ops guy, right? Or that business process person that just, you know, says, boom, I'm going to just, you know, hit you over the head and we're going to, like, you know, make things really hard, but more of like, let's work together. Let's have a defined process of what we want to have. And yes, at certain phases, having an initial check, right? I mean, what we see a lot of customers doing is, let's say, at production, right? You've gone from dev test to staging. You now hit that production lifecycle. Release manager has an approval workflow where a manager needs to be approved. But for your particular case, right, you may use other mechanisms in place to ensure that that gate is there, right? You could have Git restrictions right there. You could have Visual Studio Online restrictions for who can do the continuous builds, right? And who can push to that source code, right? You could have only particular subscriptions, right, in Microsoft Azure that only certain people have access to do deployments to. So there's a lot of different levers that you can pull there to kind of enforce things. But really, if you're working with, you know, the business and the development from early on, and you're showing like, hey, I'm going to really help things move along, you know, that's really your foundation there.
Great. Okay. I mean, it kind of cleans up most of the questions on the chat around the integration piece, the release piece, the phases. Really nice to see the questions coming through relate to how we actually built this out. The ownership, how you would interact with operations and developers, how you would assign responsibility for the different sections. So it's great to see that it actually has resonated with many people who are obviously existingly working with developers in their environment. So that kind of wraps up the release phase.
I think so. Yeah, I think with that, we're gonna call this module a wrap, and then stay tuned for the operate phase, a pretty important one for operations folks to know about. And don't just think you know everything that you need to know here. So you know, so stay tuned for the next module, and we'll see you in about 10 minutes or so.
Great.